I'm Elizabeth Madrigal.
And I'm Karen Morrison.
And we're the hosts of the Women's Mosaic, where the real lives of women and girls are shared and celebrated.
In this space, we honor the feminine and amplify the voices of women speaking their truth.
The Women's Mosaic delves into the real lives of local women through story-rich interviews, learning what works and what doesn't to enhance the health and well-being of women in our community.
We strive to share unique perspectives, resource sharing, and instructions on how to be kind by any means necessary. Welcome to the Women's Mosaic. Today we are joined by Ayanna Nance, an addiction recovery advocate. She shares her lived experience to educate, advocate, and bring hope to others. Welcome to the show, Ayanna.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So to start off our conversation, we'd like to ask you to tell us one thing you'd like our listeners to know about you, and it can be anything.
Can it be multiple things? Because I tried the one thing and it didn't quite work.
Yes,
absolutely.
Yes, we break the rules all the time here.
Okay, awesome. Something I would like the listeners to know about me is that I am Vancouver through and through. I was born here, raised here, and I still live here. My family was actually one of the first Black families to live in Vancouver, so our roots run really deep. I come from a very large family. It's the kind of family that wherever you are, like you know someone, and you grow up surrounded by history and love and a whole lot of lived experience. I am a program director for an environmental nonprofit organization, and I genuinely love what I do. My work gives me a chance to give back to the same community that shaped me. It lets me create opportunities, build connections, and make real difference in people's lives, and that means a lot to me. So I'm also just here with an open heart to share my story, hopefully touch someone's life, and let somebody know that they're not alone in their recovery journey.
So with a large family, you can't get away with anything.
Nothing.
Okay.
Nothing.
All right.
Nothing at all.
We'll have to watch ourselves, Karen.
Wow, that's another show all by itself. Wow, you're one of the first families. Are you in the first family's book?
We are, yeah.
I thought so.
Yeah.
So, Ayanna, we appreciate and admire your willingness to openly share your story. Why is it important to you to offer your voice and personal experience?
It's always been important to me, but it became more important to me just to kind of speak about what my family has gone through and what I survived right alongside them. I lost my brother Curtis in 2023, and it really pushed me to start using my voice more publicly. He passed away of an accidental fentanyl overdose, and it was the day before my birthday, and he was my world. He was like my best friend, my ride or die, as he would say, and so losing him was really, really hard. He tried really hard to rebuild his life after going to jail and facing some homelessness. But the system he had to navigate through wasn't set up for someone in crisis. So there were resources available to him, but there wasn't enough support to help him maintain those resources. And eventually he fell through the cracks and ultimately died from his addiction. And so now I speak because I need to turn my pain into purpose. It's how I protect my own recovery, and it's how I fight for people who are still trying to survive systems that weren't designed for them in mind.
You know, first of all, we're very sorry, of course, to hear about your brother and can't imagine, you know, the loss that is, particularly since you're young. I'm assuming he's young, so we're very sorry, and we're very happy that you are doing something to use your pain for power and purpose.
Thank you. I'm trying.
You're doing a great job at that, and I especially enjoy being with you when we go to Olympia to advocate for these type of issues that sometimes are overlooked, especially in the BIPOC community, where they feel like we can work this out on our own. I just sat there and, you know what? You spoke to the heart of people with power that can do something about it. You were courageous, bold and strong. And I was so happy when I heard your story that you're able to make moves and to save lives that I know you needed to be on our show.
Oh, I appreciate that. Thank you.
And she told me. She is coming on.
Here I am.
Yeah. So members of my family of origin struggled with addiction. Was this a bigger issue in your family than just your brother?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Addiction was definitely a part of my story. My mom struggled with it most of her adult life, and she had four children. I was the only girl and the baby, and I had three brothers. And out of the five of us, all of us struggled with mental health and substance use disorders at one point or another. I lost my mom and two of my brothers to addiction, and the only living brother I have is still fighting the fight. So I don't share my story to pass blame or shame anyone. It's the truth about who I am and where I come from. And so by me being able to speak about it, it just kind of helps me understand myself a little bit better, and it helps me advocate for people that are still going through it.
And that's so needed, because everyone has so many different ideas about what it means to have addiction as a genetic or a familial issue.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
So it's wonderful that you, the willingness, I think, and the openness is pretty powerful just on its own.
Oh, yeah.
And we don't believe in guilt, blame, or shame around here. We just don't. We believe in help and healing in whatever capacity that it looks like. And it's not the one size fits all.
No, definitely.
I like the fact that you're willing to speak to it, to look at it, but also to look for resources and other ideas that people may not have thought about before, but collectively we can work together to save someone going through addictions.
Absolutely, especially with platforms like this.
Thank you. Families are often bewildered why one family member spirals into addiction and others don't. Are there prevention strategies parents and guardians can use to help adolescents and young adults avoid substance abuse?
Okay, so as a mother of a 14-year-old girl and a 23-year-old young man, I can tell you that forcing our children into doing anything doesn't work. It never works. It's very unsuccessful. So one of the things that I like to practice is being honest and just creating a safe space for my kids to be able to come to me and express how they're feeling. If they're curious, if you know, they're wondering about substance abuse or anything in general, you know, you have to have a safe space where they can speak honestly.
That's right.
And then, you know, when they feel supported and seen, then they're more likely to turn to you instead of turning to substances.
You know, I think so many parents, they're really invested in their kids right up until middle school. And then
middle
school, they kind of go, okay, I did my bit. Let me out of here.
That's when the attitude comes out. The attitude comes in middle school.
That's why.
Right. And so I think that, you know, it is harder. I know with my oldest, it was so hard. She was so confrontational and verbal and in your face. And it was so hard for me not to, like,
choke
go down
her?
To that. Yeah, to choke her, right. Not to go down to that level where, you know, I was at her state of mind. You know, just to remember I was an adult.
Right.
And the safe space thing, I mean, that was a tough one.
It's
and,
hard.
You know, it's just a stage, parents out there. It's just a stage, I promise.
Mm-hmm. You get through it.
So there are many types of recovery programs, but one common theme deemed necessary that, you know, I've heard forever for a lasting recovery seems to be that an addict must first hit bottom to be able to recover. Does this concept resonate with you, and why or why not?
So it definitely does. I used to use that term a lot. I had hit rock bottom so that I knew that there was nowhere else I could go but up. But I've recently thought about it a little bit more, and I don't know if I completely agree with the statement, only because bottom looks different to everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, it wasn't one big dramatic aha moment. You know, it was a lot of little mini moments that brought me to a place where I was just like, hey, wait, this isn't for me. You know, this isn't the life I wanna live in. So I feel like when you say hit rock bottom, you know, for recovery to be possible or to maintain recovery, it's kind of kind of stating like you have to be in a horrible state to be able to seek services and really get support. So yeah, I definitely feel like you have to hit a point of no return. You have to be done, but to hit rock bottom, you know, that could be different things for different people. And some people may not have to hit rock bottom and they're still in a position where they're going to be successful in recovery.
That's actually very encouraging because I think, you know, if you are dealing with a substance abuse disorder, do you feel like you actually have to completely fail in your life before you deserve to get any kind of help or to access resources? Is, you know, just another way to stay in the addiction.
And, absolutely.
Yeah.
Wow. I like how you describe that, that it's more like a point of no return. But you can return.
Absolutely.
And the one size doesn't fit all, in some cases doesn't fit most.
Yeah.
So well-meaning loved ones often caretake, protect, rescue, and overcompensate for the person struggling with substance abuse disorder. Can you explain how this can harm someone?
Okay, so caretaking usually comes from love. You see someone hurting and you want to soften the blow for them, but sometimes the things we do to help end up protecting the addiction instead of the person. When we're constantly stepping in and covering up for someone or cleaning up the fallout, it unintentionally shields them from the reality that something needs to change. And I say that with compassion, and I'm not judging. I've been on both sides of that. But when someone is in active addiction, even basic tasks can be very overwhelming, and it's natural to want to jump in and save them from that. But if we're always catching them, then they never get a chance to feel the discomfort that can motivate change. Mm-hmm. So caretaking becomes harmful when it keeps someone from facing the truth about their situation, or when it starts to take its toll on you as somebody that's trying to be a supporter.
You're listening to the Women's Mosaic on KXRW. We've been talking to Ayanna Nance about her addiction recovery advocacy. We're going to take a quick break to hear from our sponsors and then continue our conversation.
KXRW programming like this is made possible with the support of the Columbian. I'm Will Campbell, and since 1920, my family has owned and operated the Columbian and ensured its award-winning news coverage. For the most thorough daily coverage of local news, national news, and local sports, both in print and online, and for subscription information, visit Columbian.com. That's Columbian.com.
KXRW is supported by founding partners Morrell Inc. Print and Marketing. Since 1993, Morrell Inc. has offered high-quality, creative, and innovative solutions from their women-owned, union-staffed, state-of-the-art print shop. Morrell Inc.'s experienced staff uses the latest technology to solve clients' marketing needs and within their budget. Find Morrell Inc. at morrellinc.com. That's MORELINK.com.
Thanks for staying with us. You're listening to the Women's Mosaic on KXRW. Today, our guest is Ayanna Nance, and our conversation with her continues.
You know, when they use that term, I don't know if you've heard it, Elizabeth, where they say codependent. You're a codependent.
Right, and
you're trying to help. You're trying to save a life. But yet they like put guilt on you for trying to protect your loved one. Yeah. And they said, oh, now they're codependent. And I used to question, like, am I making them or their addiction worse by showing all this compassion for what they're going through without actually have gone through it myself? So I'm trying to understand from their lens. And a lot of times people would say, well, you're making them codependent. And now you become the new addiction.
Yeah.
So when things happen, have you heard anything like that before, or is this like an odd statement?
No, I've definitely heard that. I think sometimes when someone doesn't know what to do or how to help, you do what you feel is right, and oftentimes you do what feels good for you. I was not in my active addiction when my mom and my family members were, and so I have a unique perspective on that side of things as well. I used to think that watching them hurt, seeing them in pain, struggling with withdrawals, that was something that I wanted to save them from. But as long as I made it comfortable for them to go through these things and not want to get the help that they needed, they were always going to depend on that. And so it felt good for me because I knew that I was doing something to give them the shortest way to feeling better, but it wasn't necessarily what they needed. And I think that's where the line is kind of blurred a little bit. You know, we think that we're helping, but really it's something that we're doing to make ourselves feel better.
Okay.
And so just being mindful about that and really, really getting help. Al-Anon, there's resources out there for folks if you want to know how to care for a loved one. And it is hard. It is so hard. It is very, very hard. And you blame yourself. You feel like I am the reason why they are in this position a lot of times, which then puts you in a deeper stage of kind of denial. And so first thing, easiest thing to do is put a Band-Aid over it.
That's right.
Well, you know, it took me a very long time. I have a sister who struggles with mental health issues and previously with, substance abuse. And I really thought I was just being selfless and helping her. And I felt, very committed to that. I was very concerned about her. I really hoped that I was helping her, and I thought I was. I was rescuing her. I was caretaking. I was in denial. But I was really in denial about what I got out of it. And what I got out of it was feeling like the hero.
Yes.
I mean, I hate to, I'm ashamed of it when I think back, like, oh my goodness, I had no idea at the time that it also fed some need in me to be, the savior. And I was very, I was very anguished over it. And I couldn't see that until one day my husband said to me, I don't think you're really qualified to do that. And I was like, what? And then he was absolutely right. She needed real resources, a real therapist, So I'm really glad that, you have validated that, you may think you're helping, but maybe you might need professional help.
Yeah.
For yourself and for them.
Yes.
But also for yourself. So how can a friend, an employer, or a family member support an addict without enabling them?
Supporting someone without enabling them is really about loving them in a way that says, hey, I'm here for you, but I'm not going to partake in you harming yourself. I'm not going to support you in situations that put you in danger or keep you stuck in your addiction. And that can be super hard, because someone you love is struggling, your instinct is to fix it, smooth it over, and kind of rescue them. But real support looks different for different people. It looks like listening, listening without judging, listening without trying to control the outcome, which kind of goes back to what you were saying.
Right.
We have this idea of what the right thing is. And so when we offer support, sometimes we are shaping it to what we think is right and what we think they need. And a lot of times that's more harmful. Just making sure that you're creating a space where they can try to be honest, be honest with them about what you can do, what you can't do, what you will do, and what you won't do, just setting those boundaries. It's compassion with boundaries, for lack of better terms. You're walking beside them, you're not dragging them, they're not dragging you, and it's just a mutual path that you're taking together. And sometimes the most loving thing you could do for somebody is to step back just enough for them to really get a feel for the weight of their own decisions. And, while still reminding them, hey, I'm still here for you, but you got to let them travel that road alone sometimes to feel that. And that's the balance that helps people, keep moving towards recovery and not getting stuck in their addiction.
Absolutely. My heart is hurting as you're saying all of this.
Yes.
Because I know how hard that is, to step back as the one who loves the person. And it's hard enough being the person with a disorder, but to be the person that, has no coping mechanism, really, and you're suffering because you love the person. I mean, honestly, I can feel it all again. I can feel, yes, you know, how hard it was to be dealing with that and not feeling like there was a real, you know, solution that I had access to. I mean, I didn't know what to do. I was completely lost.
And I didn't come to the realization of what support or how I enabled my family, you know, until I was in their shoes. And then I learned, I got all the tools. So it wasn't until then that I realized what I was doing, you know, and that it wasn't necessarily the best thing for them.
I wish I would have had those tools that are out there now when I was raising my son and not being sure, you know, here you are, the single mom, working two jobs, going to college, and you have this child that you can't fix.
Yeah.
And I kept thinking, you know, feeling the guilt, like, what do I need to do? Where do I need to go? And there just weren't as many resources at that time that are out there now. So this is great news to hear that things did change, and we did learn from things that didn't exist, and they exist now. You describe yourself as a recovery advocate. What does that mean to you and the community?
For me, being an advocate is really about making the pain that my family felt, like, not a waste. You know, I don't like to just talk about addiction. Like, I really want to help to invoke change. There are a lot of systems that are failing people, you know, and I want to be able to identify and hopefully change the system to where people aren't getting left behind, and making sure that people are able to get services where they're being met where they are and not expected to do, you know, some astronomical amount of, you know, tasks to maintain eligibility for programming or to actually seek, you know, services and navigate through the recovery resource system. So when I advocate, I'm fighting for things to be different. You know, I'm fighting for the policies to make sense, you know, for the services that don't punish people for being sick, for compassion to be built into a process instead of being added as an afterthought. I want to help create a world where people don't have to hit rock bottom to feel like they are worthy of help, and where families don't have to bury their loved ones before, you know, the systems change to actually meet them where they are and get them the services that could have saved their life.
Saving lives. I mean, it is, this is such a sensitive subject and such a deep problem in our society, because there is a lot of unhappiness and there is very easy access to a lot of substances. So can you talk about your own path to addiction and recovery and some of the challenges and opportunities you experienced?
Yes. Okay. So I wish I could say that one day I just kind of woke up and was like, oh, yes, you know, just addiction. I wasn't able to track, you know, where my story kind of went left. But my addiction didn't just appear out of nowhere. It came from a period where I felt like everything was falling apart around me. I had lost my mother. 5 months later, I lost my brother, my home. I pretty much had just the basic clothes on my back. And so I was kind of struggling to maintain normalcy for my kids. I thought that if I were to cry, I wouldn't stop. Like, I literally thought that I would stop myself from crying, because I thought that if I started, I wouldn't be able to stop.
Right.
And so, you know, I know now that that's an irrational belief, but that's how I felt in the moment, you know? And so I was just really trying to, like I said, maintain normalcy for my family and just trying to numb the pain. I thought that was the way to keep me from, you know, falling into a depression that I couldn't get out of.
Right.
And surprise, surprise, hey, numbing yourself doesn't fix anything. It just kind of prolongs it.
Are you sure?
Temporary.
Not much I'm sure about, and that's one of them. Yeah. That's definitely one of them. But eventually, I was in a little bit of legal trouble. I was facing an 18-month-long prison sentence, and my attorney approached me with an opportunity to opt into what's called the DOSA Drug Court program through District Court here in Clark County. And so I accepted, and what that looked like was 90 days of inpatient treatment in Spokane, Washington. And Lord, was that an experience. That's an unforgettable experience. And then after that, I returned to Vancouver, where I did some intensive outpatient and regular outpatient treatment at Community Services Northwest. I also had some different court reporting and, you know, mandatory UAing that I had to meet with a probation officer. And it took me about 2 years to complete all the phases of the program, but I did it. I graduated March 17th, I believe, of 2017. So when I graduated the program, So yeah, I joke about it being like a lot of structure. I was kind of hard-headed, and I didn't understand the rules. I thought that because I was sober, that's all that mattered. You know, I was right. Like, what are these other rules for? If I'm clean, I'm not using, I'm not doing anything. So why are you punishing me? Why are you punishing me? And I bumped heads with the judges that overseen the program quite a bit. But now I thank them because they really mm-hmm. did save my life. It was the structure that I needed. Mm-hmm. I felt like my life was unmanageable. You know, it was sheer chaos. And so that structure gave me something to kind of hold on to at a time where, you know, everything was swirling around me. But definitely looking back, the structure was great. Also, the people that I met mm-hmm. when I was there, that helped me build my recovery network. Unfortunately, you know, if we had a class of 15, there might be three of us that have maintained recovery. There have been a couple of us that have lost their lives as a part of relapse in their recovery wow. journey. Mm-hmm. So, but building that network while in the different programs that I was in through DOSA, it really helped me, you know, secure the people, my people. Because once that legal obligation is over, once mm-hmm. you no longer have that accountability over your head, it terrified me. I remember being terrified graduating the program because I'm like, who's going to make me pee in a cup? Right. Who's going to, you know, who's going to hold me accountable? You know, I don't have a prison sentence hanging over my head. And I did it. You know, I did it. I've done it pretty well, I think. And so it was a struggle. So having the people that I could rely on, it's, you know, that's kind of what held me up. Yeah, it's definitely the reason why when I talk about recovery and when I talk about advocacy, like it's not theoretical. Like this was my story. Like I lost everything. I rebuilt mm-hmm. from nothing. Mm-hmm. And here I am today, you know, 10 years strong in my recovery. And so like I like to always share that because it's real. You know, my story is real. Right. I've faced it on both sides and it's real. It can happen. I think just putting that out there gives people an opportunity to really see themselves in a position of seeking recovery treatment or getting other help that they need. So,
well, I think, you know, coming from a family that is easily addicted to anything. I mean, I was addicted to cigarettes when I was 13 and, you know, the first time I smoked a cigarette and I saw the addiction of other substance abuses in my family, you know, on both sides. What I really didn't think, I mean, I always knew I had an addict's personality. I never doubted that. I just knew from my early experience with cigarettes and trying to quit cigarettes. And so I think one of the things that does happen to a lot of people is that they do think it's not going to happen to me, particularly if they've seen it in the family.
Yeah,
they think, absolutely. I'm not going to do that. I'm not going there. And you know, it's great.
You are listening to part one of our interview with Ayanna Nance, an addiction recovery advocate on the Women's Mosaic on KXRW. Part two will broadcast in 2 weeks.
For more information about addiction recovery and treatment referral services, you can also call the free SAMHSA's, and that's SAMHSA. National Helpline at 1-800-662-4357. And that's our show. New episodes broadcast on the second and fourth Tuesdays, but you can stream any episode online anytime.
We are so grateful to our guests for sharing their knowledge and life experiences with us in their support of the health and well-being of women and girls.
So until next time, be kind by any means necessary.
And remember to honor your power.